All right, welcome back from Thanksgiving, everybody. Hope you all had a great rest before the preparation period for the last week of class and final exams, to which we're in the lead up right now. Today we're going to talk about remote sensing and mapping. We have another lecture coming up on Wednesday on how to lie with maps. Then we'll have the last lecture on Friday of this week, which will be a summary. We'll review the material in the entire class, and then I'll cover in a little bit more detail the material that's going to be covered on the final. Final is pretty much what you expect. Multiple choice, a little bit longer than the midterm, not too much. You will need the half sheet Scantron as before. And the time is, I believe, correctly posted on the website. I believe it's Tuesday? Wednesday, the 9th, the 7th, in the evening, correct? Yeah. Okay, welcome one and all. All right, today I'm going to talk primarily about remote sensing. In years past, when I had a little bit more class periods, I would include lectures on some of the other sequences in classes that we have in geography. That's more in the technical end of geography, where we cover the fields of cartography, and I had a lecture on automated cartography, on geographic information systems, where we have the 176 series, which some of you I know are taking, in geographic information systems, and then the 115 series in remote sensing. So I'll cover a bit of the remote sensing. I think it's the best kind of way to wrap up the class. So what is remote sensing? In this particular classic textbook, it's simply defined as the acquisition of information about an object without being in physical contact with it. So if I was able to mind read, let's say, somebody at the back of the room, I'd be able to get information and reconstruct it from somebody else at a distance. In other words, I'm not in direct measurement contact with what it is that I'm dealing with. So it's a very broadly defined term and covers quite a lot of fields. One way to divide remote sensing up into two sort of equal slices is to talk about active and passive remote sensing. In active remote sensing, we actually have something that we use as a sort of a beam or an energy force that we transmit at a target, and then we measure the response of that beam to the target. So good examples that we've already mentioned here in class are for terrain mapping, like LIDAR, where we use pulses of light, or sometimes almost individual photons that we shine at the target and then measure the beam back response. Or radar, where we send out pulses of radio waves, microwave wavelength radiation, we send out at a target and then we measure how much information bounces back from that target, often in the so-called synthetic aperture radar. In passive remote sensing, we don't necessarily send out any force. We simply act like a camera. We collect information that's already coming from the Earth's surface or from the object that we're trying to recognize. So when we take a simple photograph, an optical photograph, we're simply measuring the reflected light, in this case in the room, from various illumination light sources, from a particular location that's reflected back to my eye. So you might think of it as simply measuring a field of photons that are entering my eyes. When we do aerial photos from a plane, the plane is doing exactly the same thing. It's just doing it at a height. We have to talk about the platform and the geometry of what it's imaging. But we can also do passive remote sensing from space. In fact, much of the field of remote sensing is passive remote sensing from space. And that includes multispectral, in which we measure different parts of the electromagnetic spectrum at the same time, beyond those that we would see optically with our own eyeballs. And hyperspectrally, increasingly, where we measure thousands of, hundreds or thousands of wavelengths of light simultaneously. I talked briefly about corona when we were looking at mapping with air photos. So corona was sort of an initial point for both photography from space, but also in remote sensing, because it is imaging. So we talked about the camera system for corona and the fact that it includes several cameras designed to overlap in their extent, one with a very broad field of view that covers a large area with a good deal of geometric accuracy, and then a much narrower area at higher resolution, which we can register in using the coarser imagery, but see a lot more detail in the image. And the particular camera that Corona used was a very sophisticated one. It's actually still in use today. It's a scanning panoramic camera. And we saw the system by which the film is spooled into a re-entry capsule that drops off the satellite, falls back into the Earth's atmosphere, and then it's caught in outer space. In the air as it returns from outer space. So Corona was the beginning of the remotely sensed world. Here's a Corona image, actually a KH5 or an Argonne spy satellite image. This is declassified now, so I'm not showing you anything secret, of the Santa Barbara Channel, and you can see that this is probably taken in May or June, would be my best guess, because we've got the classic June gloom fog lying sucked in here over the channel, and it's coming up into as far as the mountains. You can see it beginning to burn off over the Channel Islands here, because those are mostly land. But if you look at the frame of it, it's very similar to the images we looked at a few days ago, where we were considering the classic 9-inch aerial, black and white aerial photograph, in that we've still got the same fiducial marks here that allow us to find the center point of the image and do standard aerial photogrammetry with it. And then, of course, the higher resolution imagery that came back up to images up to 5 or 6 feet in terms of their spatial resolution. Here's Santa Rosa Island, 1967. You can see beautiful radial patterns of the waves here, and also quite clearly the geological fault running across Santa Rosa Island that shows up nicely here. Okay, so I call that the missing decade of remote sensing, when we were doing active remote sensing in the United States, but it wasn't well known to science. In fact, it wasn't known to science at all, other than a few people who sworn to secrecy. Most people classify the beginnings of remote sensing in 1972 with the launch of a satellite called the Earth Resources Technology Satellite, or ERTS-1. It was launched in August of 1972. It looked kind of like this, and I found a black and white photograph because it's kind of a black and white era in my mind now. It had two instruments on board. One was called the multispectral scanner, and that was kind of an experimental digital instrument, and it was really designed to be a calibration instrument for the primary instrument, which was called the return beam Vidicon. The RBV, or the return beam Vidicon, was a modified television camera that was going to be able to eventually send images in real time from space. The RBV, although accounts vary somewhat, never really worked very well, although some people seem to have figured out that it gave us a lot of good images. So they often turned to the backup instrument, the multispectral scanner, to give us data, and in fact it was very quickly realized that data were quite superior in terms of quality. So most of the technological improvements through the Landsat series were based on the multispectral scanner instrument. Now, once the series began and Landsat 2 was planned, they decided to rename the series Landsat rather than ERTS. Otherwise, there'd be ERTS up to 7, I guess. And about the same time, we had the DMSP, or the Defense Meteorological Satellite Program, which was another classified program that was doing weather and climate research for the military. Again, an analog-type satellite that produced film and developed it. And GOES, the stationary weather satellites that we still see and use today. So this is all happening about the same time, development around the early 1970s. 1980s, we saw the sort of sell-off from the federal government of most of these satellite systems that had been pioneered by NASA and NOAA. In some cases, we saw the sell-off of them to private companies. And so most of these became commercial entities, which are still around today. And people still debate that. But what it did lead to is an enormous expansion in the late 1990s in the usage and the launching and the availability of these satellites, sufficient that today you see GOI images on the news or in a newspaper or on the internet pretty regularly. So some basics of the Landsat system, because this sort of set the scene for how the satellite programs continued. Almost invariably, satellites that are going into whole Earth orbit are launched from Vandenberg Air Force Base. And the reason for that is it's kind of the last piece of south-facing continental land in the United States before you reach Antarctica. So you draw a line south, you've got San Miguel Island. As long as you make it over that, you're out across the South Pacific, and the next significant piece of land you're going to run over is Antarctica. So if your satellite is going to go into what's called a ballistic trajectory, in other words, it's coming back down again immediately, it's going to crash into the Pacific, and you're not going to hurt anybody. Although there have been some spectacular failures at Vandenberg, more than you'd probably know about. What this does is, if we launch into this south-oriented orbit, so a direction of travel is from north to south as we launch and insert into orbit, it means that we, at least for the Landsat series, we rotate this way. It means that we launched into a daylight pass, so we go through the Earth's daytime while we're on the descending orbit. Then we cross the pole and come back on the ascending orbit, in which we're on the opposite side of the Earth, so now we're in darkness. So we have a darkness and a light orbit sequentially. Those come about 98.8 minutes apart in time, so we're going very quickly across around the entire Earth in 90 minutes. And it means that this is very carefully configured. It means that as we cross the equator, the local time, or the solar time, is 9:45 a.m. in all instances. And this was reckoned to be the best time to pass, to get the lower sun angle illumination, in which you can simply see more because you've got the sun illuminating the side of objects instead of illuminating the top. It's inclined at 98.2 degrees, not quite 90, so it doesn't literally go pole to pole. It comes at an angle to the Earth, and this means that it's difficult to actually orbit directly over the poles, so information over the poles is a little bit lacking. It orbits at 705 kilometers. That's above the sort of space junk altitudes, so it's more remote. But that's changed over time as well as different satellites have gone into orbit. Okay, what does that mean from the ground point of view? Well, it means that if we're sitting on the ground, the satellite's going to come from the north towards the south. It's going to cover an area on the ground called a swath. That's the area beneath the satellite which it can see. That area is in the order of 185 kilometers in width. It's going to be continuously recording along the swath, but the images are actually chopped up every 175 kilometers or so, 170 kilometers or so, into what are called scenes. So we've got rectangles that we call scenes that are influenced by the Earth's geometry. Okay, so here we come on at 9:45 local, and then now we go around the back of the Earth, and then we come down again. Well, the Earth has moved underneath us, which has the advantage that every time now we swing back down over the Earth, we image a new piece of the Earth. So we move about 2,700 kilometers towards the west, and then the next orbit's here, and the next orbit here, and so on. About every 17 days or so, it's arranged such that we come back over this orbit again exactly the same place. So if we piece all these together over the 17 days, we've got a continuous map covering the entire area. They haven't all been imaged at the same time. It's not like taking one snapshot photograph, but we can build successive images that cover enormous areas using satellite data. Okay, the last successfully launched Landsat was launched a good long time ago now. It was around 2000-2001, I believe. It was launched from Vandenberg. I was delighted to be invited to the launch by NASA. It was successful, and you could argue this was one of the most productive Landsat missions of them all, in spite of a problem that shut it down, essentially, in about 2003. Had a very different design. It has all sorts of new antennas, so it could transmit data faster because it was going to image at much higher spatial resolution. The original Landsat 1 had imaged at about 80 meters pixels, or about 79 meters pixels. Now, by Landsat 7, we were up to 15 meters, with some bands at 30 meters. So we're getting much higher resolution. It had different solar panel configuration, a very different instrument here called the Enhanced Thematic Mapper Plus. That's this instrument over here. Now, not just Landsat, but most standard satellites that image the Chinese, the Indian, the Brazilian, and so on, all different nations that involved remote sensing, pretty much image in somewhat similar ways. And basically, we take images using essentially a camera, although the actual mechanics of the camera vary quite considerably instrument to instrument. But it's imagine putting filters over that same camera so that we can split the light and then divide it up by its different wavelengths. So here we are imaging, this is from the Landsat data. In Landsat, we're actually getting six images that we would be able to see with the naked eye, although they're being sampled from just one color in the electromagnetic spectrum. Now, we actually have a seventh that we image in Landsat in the thermal, but I'll talk about that in just a second. You notice that this band in particular, things look very different. So if you take these mountains here and what they look like, they look quite bright here, they look quite dark over here. So things that show up in one light, you might say, say red, look very different when they're looked at in blue, let's say, or in green. So as we look in the different parts of the spectrum, we can see different things or different features on the landscape. And this allows us to be able to sort of customize how we look at the image to see things like water or moisture or vegetation or built-up areas and so forth. Now, a quick piece here on the electromagnetic spectrum. You probably don't worry about it too much unless you're in physics. If we go off to look at the wavelengths here, these are in meters. So 10 to the minus 6 is a micrometer. We often talk about nanometers when we talk about light at 10 to the minus 8. So as we come here into the ultraviolet, we begin to reach the areas of the spectrum that we're sensitive to as human beings. Beyond that, things like X-rays and gamma rays, obviously we can image with those, but they are increasingly not of use for imaging. Gamma rays and X-rays are obviously useful for imaging through people, but not the Earth's surface. We very quickly go through the visible light part of the spectrum. That's the types of light that we're sensitive to as human beings, which is really only a very narrow range between 400 and 800 nanometers in wavelength. Then we go beyond into the near-infrared. That's more of the infrared part of the spectrum that's just beyond the red part of our visible light. Into the middle infrared, eventually we go into the thermal infrared, which we can also sense as humans, but not as light, we sense it as heat. So once we get into the thermal infrared, we're sensing heat in those wavelengths. And eventually we go off here into the microwave, where we can also image, and then eventually TV and radio, where the wavelengths are in the hundreds or thousands of meters. Okay? So if we go to the visible part of the spectrum and just pull that out, as I said, this is about 400 nanometers over here, where it's red here is about 800 nanometers, a very tiny part of the spectrum, and we call this the rainbow, red, orange, yellow, green, blue, indigo, violet, so on. Up this end in the blues, our eye is not particularly sensitive to variances in contrast in the blues, not ideal. As we go into the greens, we become much more able to distinguish between features, and a lot of what's on the Earth's surface in terms of vegetation is green, so it shows up in this part of the spectrum. We go into the red part of the spectrum here, and again, as we cross over into the near-infrared, we're seeing things, or we're unable to see things as humans, that many other animals and plants and even insects are able to sense. In fact, many of the plant species are at their highest level of emission in the near-infrared. So that's why it's nice to image it if we're going to image things. Just take that part again and expand it. Here are the Landsat channels. So we measure one here in the between the blue and the green, one here in the green, one in the red, one in the near-infrared, and one out here in the what's called the far-infrared or the middle-infrared, plus the thermal channel. Those allow us to sample light at those particular wavelengths and then piece the images back together to see different things that have been captured in the image. Why do we choose these particular bands? Well, they're the bands that hold a lot of information about the Earth's surface. If we take what's called a spectrometer, that's an instrument which you can point at anything and just simply measure the full spectrum of the light waves that are coming off in terms of their frequency and amplitude. If we often talk about percent reflectance, so it's how much of that energy at a particular wavelength is being reflected by that object. So you'd imagine snow is very good at reflecting visible light, for example, because we see it as white. Then we call these absorbance spectra. or emittance spectrum, if we're emitting that light back out again. So if we look at something like, here we have silty water, you'll see that it pretty much absorbs right across the spectrum. It's very low percent reflectance, so it's going to look dark when we see it on an image, but it does peak right up this part of the spectrum here, around the sort of blue-green part of the spectrum. If we take something that's growing, let's say this grass lens spectrum here, you notice that it's relatively low at the blue-green end of the spectrum, but as soon as it gets into the red, and especially as it gets into the near-infrared, we suddenly get a very high spike, a peak. In sort of remote sensing jargon, this is called the red edge. As we go up there around 800 or 900 nanometers, we suddenly peak in the amount of reflectance information coming back from vegetation. So here's the same for pine trees. You can see that that peaks about the same place. But something like red sand here from a sand pit peaks very much earlier and then remains steady throughout here. So you can imagine if we took a slice down through the wavelengths here at any particular point and looked at, say, the ratio of the red band or the near-infrared band to, say, the blue band, then different properties of the surface materials would have very different values associated with those points. And that's one of the things we do in remote sensing. We use what are called band combinations, where we say take two bands and multiply them together, or take two bands and divide one by the other, that so-called band ratio. And these allow us to see things in a great deal of detail. So here's the visible light type combination of this particular area, and it looks pretty drab. It looks like a barely vegetated, fairly bare desert. When we look at it in a different band combination, this is 432 actually, so the band 4, 3, and 2 are mapped onto red, green, and blue, respectively. So now we can see that the green band, which is showing us healthy growing vegetation, the near-infrared band, which is showing us healthy vegetation, has been mapped onto red. So we can very clearly see the exact pattern of the fields, how they're irrigated, and some of these look like they're golf courses and residential areas. Where there's actively growing vegetation on them, they just pop right out as being red. Things that pop out very easily, water bodies, tarmac, urban areas, snow, clouds, unfortunately, and so on, often show up very clearly when you do these band combinations. So if we're going to extract images, we're going to extract features from these images to use on maps, it helps if we know what the spectrum is of the thing that we're trying to map. And then we can extract from the image that particular part of the image that fits our criteria. As I said, I mentioned thermal. It's the last band in Landsat. So this is Landsat. It's actually band 5, they call it. And so it skips a band in the middle. Here's the panchromatic. So this is an image taken showing an airstrip and a little settlement. Looks like it's in a remote area. It's probably either unvegetated or it's snowed in this particular area. And if we look at the panchromatic, that simply means that we take the light across the full spectrum and look at all the contrast variation. We just get a sort of a flat, in this case, monochrome view. If we then go to the thermal band, we can get additional information. So thermal is sufficient. It's not super high resolution, but it's sufficient that if, for example, a plane sits on a runway and revs its engines for 10 minutes before it takes off, that thermal pattern is left imprinted in the runway. And it's going to be there emitting light for thermal energy for a good 10, 15 minutes before it cools off sufficiently we can't image it anymore. So we can often see things, sometimes people walking or animals, in the thermal band that we're not going to see in the visible band. In this case, we've got two buildings on this little settlement that are clearly not being heated. So they show up as just black in the thermal infrared, whereas all the other buildings in the runway, which has traffic on it, it's heating it up, it's absorbing sunlight, so it's re-emitting the energy from the sun that it's absorbing. All of those show up, but we don't see these two buildings. So we might surmise that something is different about those two buildings. Perhaps they've been abandoned, or their heat isn't working, or something like that. Now, one of the things we can do when we deal with digital satellite images rather than analog images like photographs is that we can sort of do statistical analyses on the information content. So usually we can only display three channels at once, and in the visible on a screen we see red, green and blue, and we combine them to make all the colors that we're going to see in an image. But obviously we can choose any of the channels to map onto those three visible bands. Once we display them, we can look at what are called the histograms. So these are band histograms, so we can look at both the cumulative and the actual histogram, the frequency of occurrence of intensity of radiation in that wave band across the range. Now the range of the data that we can collect is sort of like the density or the resolution of the imagery in the spectral domain. And usually we characterize those with only 256 levels from no light at all to fully saturated in that color. Or sometimes we can characterize them at much larger ranges, but we can only display them at the 256 levels. So here, for example, the blue is much more uniformly spread across the range than the green, which favors the lower levels. And the red is pretty low across just this middle range. So we might say to ourselves, what can we do to simply take those histograms and make them a little bit more realistic so we can see things in the image that we wouldn't necessarily see otherwise? So doing that, by the way, is called image enhancement, and we can use the image histograms to do the enhancement. Resolution, I mentioned spectral resolution. We also talk about spatial resolution. Here we are at 100 meters, and although you can see different combination pixels and their colors, like these are clearly blue, these are clearly green, you can't see an enormous amount of detail when we're imaging at 100 meter resolution. 100 meters is often fine for, say, doing land use mapping, but it's not going to cut it for many other applications. We go to 30 meters resolution, what Landsat image is at. We can see things like individual bridges. We can see the Mall here in Washington, D.C. We can see the House of Congress up here and the Potomac River quite well. We go to 5 meters. We begin to see lots of individual detail. Boat docks, the roads on the Mall, the White House, the approach lanes here at the end of 66 and so on. One of the things we can also do is that we can take different channels that have imaged at different parts of the spectrum, and even though they're different spatial resolutions, we can still superimpose them. So here we've got an image that has red has been mapped onto the thermal infrared, blue is mapped onto blue, and green's mapped onto green, but we've combined that with the panchromatic image at a much higher resolution. So we've sort of merged the slightly fuzzier color information with very crisp black and white information. And this sort of enhances the image that we're using. And this gives us a good deal more data. As you can see, this is the UCSB campus. There's Campbell Hall right there. And you can see that this is before they replaced the awfully muddy playing fields over here with the synthetic surface. That used to be a complete shambles. Okay, when we often, after we process the imagery and we've done our enhancements, let's say we've scaled an image up or scaled it down or balanced it, we end up with three channels, red, green, and blue, and then we combine these to make the regular color image that we're used to seeing day to day, although we don't often map these same channels back onto the exact same channels that we would see visibly. We take advantage of the fact that the human eye is very much better at seeing contrast in red and green than it is in blue. Just by seeing those three images, which are all normalized to the same reflectance, you can see that we can see a lot more contrast here and here than we can in here. So if we take the channels that we want to see more detail in and map them onto red and green, we're going to be much better at interpreting what it is we want to see in an image. So a lot of our photo interpretation maps the near infrared channel onto red. So vegetation, rather than looking green, looks red, so that we can distinguish it from other things on the landscape. OK, Okay, here's an interesting sequence that gives you some sense of what can be done when we can digitally process data. Now, this sequence is now so commonplace and it's so commonly done that it's now actually pre-programmed into a lot of high-end digital cameras. So it's actually doing these enhancements for you without you knowing. You know, things like red spot removal in eyes and edge enhancement and color correction. So we used to have to do this in software. Now it can be done pretty much in real time when you take a photograph. So here's an example of how we can enhance an image. Here's an original image of this particular view. There's people that work in image processing, by the way. There are sets of sort of classic images that have long been used in the literature, and everybody does the research on these images so that you can see how your techniques perform in comparison to everybody else's. This is one of those images. What do? We run a filter across it that gives us the areas that have higher contrast than others. We then take that and enhance it to boost the brightness in it and lose the backdrop here, make it black. We then take a mask, so we simply take everything that's an edge within the image and blur it so that it gets a wider area than we had previously. And we multiply that mask by that image. So this is just the high contrast areas. This pulls out just the high contrast areas near edges. And then we can add this to our original image and produce this enhanced image. So we can produce an enormous amount of extra detail within the image just by sort of playing with the data that we already have. And very often when we do image processing to extract things like roads or urban areas or vegetation patterns or trees or whatever, we're doing exactly this. We're using clever tricks to pull out the parts of the image that we're most interested in extracting and therefore mapping. So here are some examples. Here's some imagery from Mount St. Helens area, which you can see is where it used to be, rather. It's gone. Well, most of the top of it has gone. And here the problem is that most of the brightness responses within the image are towards the low end on the darkness scale. So there are very few bright things in the image and a lot of dark things. So all we can, if we can statistically turn that around so that the average part of the image is much brighter, we just simply move that spectrum across, those histograms across, and make everything brighter in the image. We end up with this. So we're doing image brightening on this image, and we can see a lot more contrast here. Wrong thing. Here we go. So if we go further than that, we can do what's called histogram equalization. In histogram equalization, we force each part of the spectrum or each part of the histogram to have an equal number of pixels within it. Now, this has the effect of really enhancing the contrast within the image and allowing us to see a lot more detail. So even though we lose some aspects within this, like the very bright areas become saturated in this process, we gain it by having a lot more contrast, say, down here in the lakes or up here in the valleys. Here's an image normalization routine in which we force each part of this histogram to be Gaussian, to be normally distributed. And again, this does some of the enhancement, but some of the brightening at the same time. Here we do image sharpening. In image sharpening, we do exactly what I just showed you with the photographic image. We look for areas of high contrast and replace those into the image so that we enhance the edges of things and make things a little bit more visible. So if you look at this stream flow, or I believe it's a lava flow here, you can see it in a lot more detail in this image now. Okay, I mentioned that Landsat 7, even though it gave us wonderful data in its early life, picked up a serious problem in May of 2003 when one of its, what's called a scanline corrector, failed on the satellite. You can't just sort of walk up into space and fix it. Actually, they did attempt to do that in Landsat 4. They attempted to retrieve it with the shuttle and fix it, but they ended up not doing that. They chose a Hubble instead. But this particular problem means that Landsat, since 2003, Landsat 7 has only really been doing a good job of imaging points that are directly beneath it. And as soon as you get off from nadir, the effect of these scanline correctors come into play. At first, at a sort of gross line, only an image or so, only a pixel or so wide, but as we get further and further away from the center of the image, these get broader and broader. A lot of people have tried to fix this unsuccessfully. People have tried software solutions to it. It doesn't work. The solution is to just launch another satellite, but it's taken 10 years of bickering in Congress to decide whether or not to actually have a Landsat follow-on mission. Right now, the evidence seems to point to actually doing one, but with the budget the way it is right now, it's probably an easy item to slash another few billion dollars off of NASA's budget. So we've had a lot of other types of instruments coming in to take up the gap, fortunately. Among them, ASTO, an extraordinary instrument on NASA's Mission to Planet Earth missions. The MODIS, which is a moderate resolution, the coarser resolution imaging device. The airborne, very high resolution radiometer, which is not airborne. It's not very high resolution either. It's kind of coarse, it's 1 kilometer to 4 kilometers. The French SPOT series of satellites, which has been through 5 or 6 different satellites now in their series. Digital Globe, Iconos, these are commercial satellites that have gone through several different owners as the companies have shaken out in the last few years. The Landsat follow-on mission, which apparently is still alive. And now a huge number of different satellite information suppliers from all sorts of other countries around the world that have gotten in on the act, and meaning that now we sort of have a surplus of sources of satellite data, just more than you could even use. Now, in addition to that, we've also seen the rise of what's called hyperspectral remote sensing. In hyperspectral remote sensing, you're not limited to the 5 or 3 or 5 or 7 channels that you would have on, let's say, a Landsat. You don't have to aggregate over a series of wavelengths to produce an image. Instead, you can image in very narrow slices, and you can have a lot of them from the same data. So the hyperspectral images, things like Avaris, were able to image in the hundreds of bands, up to 140 or so. An instrument that was originally classified, has been declassified, called HIDICE, can image literally in the thousands of bands, sufficient that you can almost do a chemical analysis of the ground, a complete spectrometer analysis of the substance of the ground, the chlorophyll content of leaves and things like that. The technology was originally designed for looking through smokestacks to see exactly what was being manufactured inside factories, because the particulates were a complete giveaway on what chemicals and substances were being made. So we now talk about what's called a data cube, in which we have the spatial domain this way, X and Y, and then the entire spectral domain right across the electromagnetic spectrum going the other direction. And you can imagine that as we move backwards and forwards within this cube, certain things on the landscape show up much better. Let's say minerals with a particular ore content, or glaciated landscapes, or snow, or roadways are going to show up on at least one of these thousands of possible wavelengths that we're going to be able to produce. Okay, at this point, I'm going to simply just show you a lot of satellite images, because there's no, I can go on talking about it forever, but ultimately, interpreting and using and seeing these images is the way you gain experience with them. So as we talked about interpreting aerial photos a couple of weeks ago, a week or so ago, I talked about where is this location, what's happening in this image, and when was it taken. These are all relevant. I'm going to give you some of the details, but you might be able to fill in some of them yourself. So anybody recognize where we are in the world here?
Alaska.
Okay, here's the Aleutian Chain heading out this way. Part of Canada here, in the United States again, back down here. And we've obviously got all sorts of things happening. This is clearly a cloud. This is snow. Okay, we can see haze and fog effects here. We can see what's probably fog off the surface here. Then we can see deeper patterns here, which are probably ocean coloration coming through within the image. So we get an enormous amount of information from these images. You can see that things like ridgelines in the weather systems are going to appear as bands of fog and stuff here. Okay, again, enormous amount of information going on at the same time. This is actually also the coast of Alaska. This is after a record snowfall. Let's see if my annotations show here, but not on there. This is Alaska record snowfall in March of 2002. So we've got just an enormous, so we've got coastal cloud patterns here, we've got patterns here. This might be a single aircraft contrail that's turned into high altitude ice crystals, and it becomes quite visible within the image. Okay, where? Great Lakes, okay, and should be able to recognize Lake Superior here, and Lake Michigan here. Chicago would be right down here somewhere. You can just see the thumb of Michigan sticking out here. Why are all these streaks coming off the lakes? We got classic lake effect snow. So what do we need for snow? Well, here it's obviously not snowing. It's very cold, but it's not snowing. To snow, we need moisture in the air. You know, it's like precipitation falls only when there's moisture in the air. So here we've got the wind blowing over the Great Lakes. You can see that the edges of the lakes, you can see that the wind is coming from the upper left-hand side of the image in this case. We've got a clear part of the lakes where the water is evaporating into the atmosphere, and as soon as it gets saturated enough, it starts to snow. And the snow continues to be blown by the winds off in this direction. It all flows down. It's not my phone, is it? No. It all flows down in this direction, and eventually everything congregates on Buffalo, New York. That's a little meteorological joke there. Okay. Well, you can see the annotation on this one. This is the Ross Ice Shelf, just off the tip of South America in Antarctica. And here we're getting some really unique patterns. Much of Antarctica, ironically, has extremely low rainfall. What rain it does get, it falls as snow, and it doesn't snow very much, but once it does snow, it doesn't go away. It stays there for a very long time. So it's ironically very dry region. If it were on land, it would be a desert with very little moisture. Here we can see a spiraling storm pattern developing. We can see icebergs carving here off the Ross Ice Shelf. Here we can see dry land on Antarctica, which you don't think about, but there is some there. Okay, so a very different part of the world given away by the pattern of the graticule in this particular instance. Okay, now we're again in a very different part of the world. I know where it is, but you don't. Any guesses? We're in the southern hemisphere. We're off of the Great Barrier Reef in Australia. Okay, probably near somewhere like Cairns in Queensland. So we've got all sorts of objects we can see. Here's obviously the coastline. And we can see the shallower water along the coast. And then when the water suddenly gets deeper, you can see it by the pattern of blue in the water. Then we come up against these guys. These are coral reefs. So this is the Great Barrier Reef. These are colonies of coral. These are plants, growing plants. Have an enormous amount of species that grow on them that are dependent upon each other. And then these little patches out here are clouds. So you very often get this patchy cloud pattern within Pacific environments and small islands. So move on. Same thing here, Great Barrier Reef. Now you can see the coast of Australia. Great Barrier Reef itself in full. And here's this patchy cloud patterns that often form. Just to prove there are clouds there, if we zoom in and look one, this is on an aerial photograph, you can see here's the coral surrounding the island, here's the sand that comes mostly from coral that's been destroyed and turned into sand, here's the little tiny island with its vegetation, and because there is vegetation, it's got evapotranspiration, the moisture that generates goes straight up and then condenses immediately over the top. So this is a very, very characteristic Pacific island type feature. You travel through the South China Seas and Southeast Asia, you see this pattern over and over again. Okay, where are we right now? Let me check my... Oh, I didn't have notes on this. A little hint here. This is after a large rain event. So here we have the ocean. You can see by the dark and light patterns of blue that we have some material finding its way out in almost in channels here. So here we actually have subterranean or sub-oceanic canyons here, probably formed when the ocean level was at much lower level, and we had streams cutting into these canyons, and then they reflood. The New York City has a classic example, the Hudson Canyon. And here, because we've had a recent rain event, this entire estuary that would normally look like water looks like mud. Well, it looks like sand in this case. So you can see the enormous amount of sediment that a rain event pushes out into the ocean. And these eventually forms deltas and so on. Here you can see some more of it. The rest of these are clouds. Again, back in the coral areas, a barrier island here. This looks like Key West in Florida. And again, you can see the same pattern. You can see the coral formations with a shallower ocean and then suddenly becoming very deep. Best place to scuba dive is right on that edge where you've got it nice shallow on one side and you get back quickly, but you get to see some of the neat things going on as the water gets a little bit deeper. We've seen this peninsula a few times in class. Anybody identify where we are in the world? This is Korea, North Korea, South Korea, Japan. Pointing out here, this feature right here, what do you think that yellowish area over the ocean is? Dust storm, yeah. So we've got northern China, the plains up there, some of the areas have experienced sort of overuse of irrigation for agriculture that have resulted in the lands really reverting to desert. And then when you get big winds, the winds pick up the sand material, move it out into the atmosphere. Beijing suffers terribly from these sandstorms that can make it almost make the air quality almost uninhabitable for days at a time sometimes. Where? Got it. Tasmania, off of Australia. There's Melbourne up there. What would be causing this? Fire. So this is smoke, not cloud. And you can see the pattern. Here we've got large parts of Queensland and Australia, or it'd be South Australia there, on fire, and the smoke blowing out over Tasmania. So we often get this condition wherever there are fires around this area, you know, say San Diego or somewhere like that. The wind's blowing towards us. We get the dust and the ash and the outfall from the fires. So this has been enhanced to show vegetation detail in the ocean. Anybody guess what these things are? This is the coast of British Columbia and Alaska. Now these are huge vortices that form in the ocean currents off of the ocean. Very often when you get these trapped, there's one there, for example, it changes the heat and salt concentration or the temperature of the water, and that changes the biology. So sometimes you get algae blooms in particular wavelengths that you can see under certain conditions. So you get very elaborate patterns. Here's one on the Gulf Stream. There's Long Island and Maryland here. Here's the Gulf Stream heading out towards Europe. And again, you get these vortices, huge, 1,000-kilometer across type features. Just a couple more because we're running out of time. Here we've got two extreme processes taking place. Southern Spain, and in this case Portugal, have exactly the same climate as Southern California, so they get fires in the summertime or in fire season too. Here's a pretty active fire burning right there. But here we've got, because it's dry, we've got sand being picked up over the Sahara Desert and being blown out towards the west. And studies in the last 10 years have been analyzing the soils in Brazil and in the Amazon and found that an important content of the nutrients in the soil actually comes from the Sahara Desert and blows all the way across the Atlantic and finds its way into South America. New Zealand, after a major storm event, you can see lots of sediment running off here. Interesting vortices over the Cape Verde Islands. running out of time, so I'll cut the commentary. Volcanic eruption on Sardinia. There it is in the thermal. So I'll leave you that image. So no, let's cut to the summary. Here we go. Didn't get enough time for all these. So we can measure objects without being in contact with them. Lots of public domain programs with plenty of data available. Satellite programs date since 1958, and image processing can reveal an enormous amount of hidden information from the images useful for mapping. Okay, see you on Wednesday.